Coming up on Boston Public Radio, new WGBH contributor and former Phoenix political columnist David Bernstein. He'll join us to preview tonight's Senate debate. Yes, there is one. And to talk about mayoral candidates' response to recent violence in the city. Then we'll talk Starbucks versus Dunkin' Donuts. Which side are you on? Plus, Harvard's Nancy Kane will let us in on the strategies of the two coffee giants and what your choice says about you. Marjorie?
Brian McRoy, editor of the Boston Globe, joins us for open mic at 1 o'clock to talk about the Whitey Bulger trial and to reveal a secret about himself inquiring minds are dying to know. Stay tuned. Then, this is going to be so much fun, a new list of the 101 best-written television shows ever. And my favorite show, Jim, I'm happy to say, comes in at number one. All that is up next on Boston Public Radio. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Very fetching today, Jim.
Thank you. You're looking pretty good yourself.
Welcome.
Can we start with an update of my favorite story, if we
Certainly.
Can? Yeah. You know, yesterday we shared with all of you the Globe's account of the travails of Leslie Cohen Berlowitz. She's the 600 grand a year first class flying head of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. The Globe discovered she had said she had PhDs she did not have, though they were included in grant applications to the feds to attempt to get more than $1 million, and actually also included on her, I love this, her pre-death obituary, which had been prepared by the Academy. Well, yesterday we read to you what her spokesperson, the former spokesperson for Governor Weld, had to say. Can you share that with us again, please?
Certainly. This is Ray Howell. I feel a little bad for Ray Howell today. Here's what he said. Neither the Academy nor President Berlowitz is going to respond to subjective, interpretive, and gossipy allegations from former employees and unnamed sources, nor are they going to respond to personal questions that are irrelevant, do not belong in the public domain, and frankly, smack of sexism.
Good for them. In any case, there's another Globe story from Todd Wallach today. A little bit of a follow-up. It turns out that including these non-existent doctorates on applications to the National Endowment for the Humanities, in return for which they got $1.2 million, may actually be a crime. What did Ray Howell have to say today, Marjorie?
He says, President Berlowitz, who reviewed only the substantive content of the applications, was unaware of the mistakes.
Even though, by the way, every article you read about this woman, and now we're consuming everyone we can, says she's a micromanager to the nth degree. In any case, thanks to a wonderful listener, we didn't have to just rely on Todd Wallach's great pieces the last 2 days. We also found two terrific pieces done by the legendary curmudgeon of the Boston Globe, Alex Beam, in 2003 and 2006 about Ms. Berlowitz. And I know you've selected a passage from one of his 2006 columns. You want to share that with us, too?
Yes. Over the past few months, this is Alex Beam, a group of young staffers who call themselves the UAAASHH or the Unofficial American Academy of Arts and Science Happy Hour Group have been meeting at watering holes like the Newtown Grill in Porter Square or the Thirsty Scholar
place.
In Somerville. Quote, we meet every 3 weeks to discuss the latest antics and outrages of Leslie Berlowitz, the executive director of the American Academy. Former AAS visiting scholar Lisa Fivels wrote to me earlier this year.
Wrote to Alex.
Yes. And this Friday, the group plans to see The Devil Wears Prada, not because they're partial to Meryl Streep, the star, but because the tyrannical overlord of the fictional Runway magazine reminds them so much of Berlowitz.
Classic Alex Beam. Well, congratulations to Todd Wallach and Alex Beam. When Globe editor Brian McGroy joins us in a little less than an hour, we're going to get his take on this Berlowitz story, too. But here we go. Nothing, I assume you'd agree, could be worse than waking up tomorrow morning, reading the paper, only to find out you forgot to watch tonight's Senate debate between Gabriel Gomez and Ed Markey. Don't say we didn't give you warning. Joining us in Studio 3 for debate primer is the just-announced new and regular contributor to GBH television and radio, David Bernstein. David, congratulations and welcome.
Oh, it's a thrill to be on the team.
We are really thrilled.
Well,
we heard about it yesterday.
We were
very excited.
David
very
is a
excited
about
great,
it.
Great political reporter, so it's going to be wonderful to get his perspective on local politics, starting with what's going on tonight, big first debate between Ed Markey and Gabriel Gomez. What are we expecting, David?
Well, this is the downside of this gig is that I now have to actually watch this debate instead of watching the hockey game, I guess. But, you know, the Gomez team has really been, from what I can tell, for some time, really focusing in on the debates as their potential sort of start to the end of the campaign. That this is where they think they're going to pick up momentum. They're going to, you know, game change, whatever you want to call it. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's been their strategy. They have a lot of focus on the debates. So there's a lot riding on it for him. My guess is that you're going to see Gabriel trying to knock Markey off his game, you know, and try to, you know, I think that you might see him come after Markey with brand new attacks or new spins on attacks or, you know, things that he hasn't really emphasized before in a hope to get Markey befuddled or defensive so that you'll get some good clips out of it of Markey looking like he's angry or doesn't have a response about something, about his own record or whatever it might be. Gomez wants to put Markey on the defensive, I think, tonight.
Well, stay there for a second. Yeah. What are, other than the fact that he has served 30-plus years, Markey, in the most dysfunctional institution in America, I mean right. that seriously, right. 90% of Americans agree with the latter comment, what are the vulnerabilities of Ed Markey? What can you attack him on? I mean, his record, even if you disagree with the policy, is pretty impressive.
Jim,
he has done bipartisan. What's it?
He redacted his address from his
okay,
taxes.
Okay, fine, I know. Yeah. But I'm serious. So what do you attack the guy on?
Well, I think that's the big question is that, you know, the coming in, there was a sense, well, you can attack him on not really being connected to Massachusetts. And everybody, you know, sort of accepts that.
And Marjorie wrote about that when she interviewed all his neighbors didn't know who he was.
Right. And everybody's gone out, you know, they make plenty of hay out of that, and I'm sure that they will do so again. I don't get the sense that it resonates very much for people for whatever reason. They kind of get that someone who's been in Congress that long is a creature of Washington, you know, and for good or ill. So that's certainly been one line of attack. Another one is, you know, he doesn't have a lot of bills to his name, which is very, I think, dishonest attack, but that they've been renewing this morning, the Gomez campaign. Just because you don't have bills that have your name that got all the way through the process, he's actually affected a lot of legislation through amendments and through bills that got tucked into other things. And, of course, he sponsored bills that didn't get to passage because of Republican resistance, you know. So, but that's one line of attack. But I think that what you might see is a combination of those kinds of things and sort of attacks on Markey's own record, like a particular votes. You saw Lynch do this in one of the debates, and sort of, you know, why did you vote against this Homeland Security expansion or this particular thing?
When you were one of very few Democrats, just two or three Democrats to do it.
Exactly.
Even though his contention is because I had the courage to do the right thing because it didn't go far enough.
And you saw that the first debate that Lynch did that, it really did get Markey on the defensive and befuddled him. Then he came back very strong when he was prepared to answer it. So that's why I'm thinking that the Gomez team may be holding back some attack that they want to spring on Markey, whether it's tonight or maybe at a later debate.
Two more debates after tonight, we should say.
You know, including
the consortium debate that is going to be done right here at WGBH.
We're talking with political reporter David Bernstein, who's working here now at WGBH. You just mentioned that the idea of Markey living in Washington doesn't resonate with people, but you're much more of an expert at this than I am. Why would you redact your address from your income tax? It just kind of looks odd. I mean, either he's living in the house over there in the M-Town, which one M-Town? I always goof it up. Which
Medford.
Is the M-Town I live in? Medford. I can't Malden,
no,
Medford.
No,
Malden.
Yeah, it's Malden.
Oh, it's Malden?
Yeah,
it's Malden.
You
I guess
it
I screwed
up
it
the
up
M-Towns.
Too.
They're all alike. They're all alike. Anyway, in Malden. Or he's down there in Chevy Chase, I guess it is, where the wife is a physician.
Well, that is what it is. I mean, isn't it fairly obvious that that's what
but
it
isn't
is?
Isn't that odd to redact your address?
One way or another, yes.
It looks suspicious.
It's odd because it draws more attention to
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, you know, as Tom Menino said about a number of things when asked about Markey's campaign, I can't explain it.
Well, let me ask you another thing, too, that bothers me because it doesn't seem senatorial to me. Gabriel Gomez calling Markey pond scum and then constantly talking about his running a dirty campaign. I hear that and I cringe.
Markey's not going to raise that. John Keller is going to raise that, the moderator.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the case?
I would think that John Keller will maybe even start the debate by saying to Gabriel Gomez, will you be man enough to say it to his face right now?
I think that'd be great. Remember that great moment? What was the moment like that when John King turned to the former governor of Minnesota? What was his name? and who had been making fun of Romney and Obamacare.
God, how quickly we
and
forget.
Said, turn
oh, Polenta,
to.
Polenta.
Oh, that's right, Polenta.
Turn
right.
to Mitt right, Romney. Right. And they went back and forth, and he wouldn't right. do it, and that ended his campaign.
You say Romney, Obamacare.
Obamacare,
was the,
yeah.
Right. Oh, that's good. That's
Thank you very
good,
much.
Yes. Very good, Jim.
I actually watched that debate. You know, but can but, we flip. I'm sorry, go.
I was just going to say that is kind of unsenatorial.
I do think that it's a little unsenatorial, and I think that it was a bad move. I also think that we see in a number of ways that Gomez and his campaign, instead of just making an argument that might resonate, they always sort of go over the line and, you know, hyper, you know, this thing about, oh, Markey's never passed a bill in 30 years or whatever. Nobody believes when you go that far.
Yeah.
If you make some, you know, real attack, like, well, he hasn't accomplished on X, Y, and Z. Okay, people will buy that. But, you know, it's always sort of a step over the line and calling him pond scum, I think, is
yeah, yeah, I think so.
And people just tune that sort of thing out.
I haven't called anybody pond scum in weeks, and I've really been chastened by this experience.
Well, I do it all the time, but I'm not trying to get votes.
Actually, it was you I was talking. Okay. Now, David Bernstein, let's flip sides just for a second here and talk about the vulnerabilities of Gomez. It seems to me that if he hits hard, he, Markey, on the, well, tell us how you would have voted on these measures in Congress that would have limited access to abortion. The problem with that, in terms of the viewer, even though I think those are important questions, is Gomez is going to turn right back at him and do what Steve Lynch is. Why don't you then explain to us why you attempted to pass a constitutional amendment to ban abortion? I mean, he's going to say it was 30-some years ago, but essentially that's considered a wash. So I am of the belief, and maybe this is self-serving because I've asked Gomez about this a lot, this whole issue of not disclosing anything about your clients or right. what you did for last nine years of your life in the private equity business at Advent International, that's a pretty serious line of attack, is it not?
I do, and particularly because if Gomez's attack tonight is going to be a lot about sort of, you know, your record, you know, Ed Markey, you know, what's your record? You know, what have you done? Why don't you tell us, you know, more about where you've spent your time, you know, how often you're in Malden, how often you're, you know, when did you vote on this, all that kind of thing. It becomes very easy for Markey to turn around and say, look, my record is in the congressional record. I'm an open book for the last 30-some years. We've had reporters following me around for 30-some years, and I'm an open book. How can you ask when we don't know anything about you? Well, you know, if you're going to ask the question, if you're going to demand my history, where's your history? You know, I think that becomes
so. Does he release a client list? I don't mean this is a joke at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me. You know, one last question about the debate, and then we want to move to the mayoral race, which I think you probably know more about than anybody alive, other than maybe even including the candidates. So seriously, I mean this sincerely. Which of the two candidates mentions the Bruins first? I'm serious about that. Don't you think that's going to be in the opening answer of one of them?
If they're not stupid, yeah, I
right away.
Agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Go Bruins.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the mayoral thing for a second. One of the things that Marjorie, I know you've handicapped, you've done this power index or whatever it's called in Boston Magazine. What did you do? You interviewed 78 experts and then you trashed what the 78 experts said. Did you not do
that? Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. Okay, let's forget that. One of the things, Marjorie and I talk a lot about the response to violence in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, that sort of thing. We had a weekend that was almost unparalleled. I think there were three murders. I may be off by one. I don't mean to be disrespectful by getting the number wrong. Close to 10 shootings or thereabouts. I read last night every press release I could find from every one of the candidates who's gotten through the signature threshold. I couldn't find, maybe Dan Conley, who's the DA, obviously it's his job. I couldn't find one candidate who even had an opinion. Right. About that. Is that a fair representation of where we are?
I think it is. And I would go further. I would say that you know, look at the whole debacle that just went on over the fire chief who, got criticized by his deputies.
And finally stepped down
while the mayor and the commissioner of the fire department were standing by him. But he eventually had to stand by. Well, where are the candidates on that? Well, you know, do they think that the mayor, you know, there was a wrong pick for fire chief? Do they think, you know, that that this was caving in to the firefighters? Let's go back a little further. When Carol Johnson, superintendent of schools, you know, announced her resignation, where were the candidates saying, I think she's done a great job, or I think she's done a poor job, or this is what we need in the next superintendent? I think that right now what we have, and sort of understandably to a certain extent, we have candidates who are just putting together their campaigns, still trying to figure out where they're trying to make their, you know, and they've got their little policy teams, you know, meeting to write up their policies and everything. And they, you know, they, So they're being very cautious right now on the sort of, you know, day-to-day things happening in the city, responding to them. But I think that's bad for the debate, and yep. and I think that the media should be going after them.
Well, I want to disagree with you a little bit. Maybe you're right about the you know, they want to get their act together before they speak in potentially a controversial way. I thought you were touching on a second ago exactly what I think it is, which is they're all too scared to say anything that may be yes. seen as a criticism of Tom Menino. I've had maybe six or seven of the candidates on my television show, and I ask every one of them, tell me the best and the worst of Tom Menino. They all tell the best. Oh, well, we're not talking about the past. And the only one who had the courage to admit, I said, so is this because you don't think he did anything wrong or because you're scared of him? The only one who had the courage to laugh and say it's the latter was Marty Walsh. He said, I don't want to upset. But that is what it is.
Good
if you
Marty
say
Walsh.
Carol Johnson was a bad pick, then you're criticizing Menino.
Right.
If you say that the fire chief was a bad pick and you're with the 13 deputies, right. you're criticizing Menino. If you talk about crime and these murders and shootings, then you're saying that Ed Davis and Tom and Eno are not doing a good enough job.
Right. Yet John Conley, that you have, is spending the most money with this pretty ramped up campaign.
Yeah.
John Conley is a city councilor who has been very critical of the Boston public schools.
Yep.
The teachers union has said, forget John Conley. We're not going to give any support to him. I think he's on the right track. I don't disagree with I disagree totally with the Boston teachers union approach to education fixing in Boston. He's been at least willing to criticize
the mayor. But he declared when it was one-on-one, he had no choice. The conventional wisdom then was he was running right. against Tom Menino. We didn't know Menino was going to be sitting on the sidelines with everybody begging him for support.
That's right.
Right.
And it really is remarkable. Like, you know, John Conley, as you said, who in the past called for Carol Johnson's resignation when she announced that she was going to be leaving, did not, you know, make a big fuss out of it.
Is that
not,
so?
Did not come forward. I didn't get any release. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get any comment out of them.
So what's that about? He's chickening out now? The field is so big, like all, Jim just said?
Yes, they're all chickening out. They're all quite chicken.
I love that phrase, by the way, chickening out.
At least for the moment. You know, they are, you know, they're all trying to raise money from people. They're all trying to get, you know, the activists, the sort of, you know, machinery people, the endorsements, the union groups, whatever, they're all afraid to alienate any of them right
yeah.
now because of, you know, and at some point, you know, like, it is kind of baffling. Like, aren't there some of them who can just say, look, I'm never going to get the firefighters' endorsement. I'm going to come out, you know, and say what I think about this situation with the deputy chief. But they're all just afraid to alienate anybody right now.
Last thing for me, David Bernstein, brand new exclusive contributor to WGBH TV and radio. And we're really thrilled you were here, by the way. What is the likely number that are going to have submitted enough signatures mm-hmm. so they're in the preliminary, the field that ultimately will be narrowed to two? What's the number likely?
I think we're looking at 12, maybe 13. I think that we're at Bill Walczak apparently made it this morning. I'm expecting Mike Ross to make it later today. So I think that gets us to 11. And so I think, you know, one more, whether it's Dave Portnoy or, you know, Charles Clemens or John Lang might make it. So, you know, somewhere in that range, 12, 13.
As he's saying this, people sitting at home or in the car saying,
who are those
exactly?
people?
Dave Bernstein, it's a thrill to have you here. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much. David Bernstein is WGBH's political analyst and a contributing editor to Boston Magazine. And after tonight, by the way, you want to know this because I know everybody's riveted by these debates, Gomez versus Markey. Two more, Western Mass on June 11th and the final one will be here, WGBH, June 28th. Okay, it's becoming as old as the Boxers versus Brief debate or the Mac versus PC, Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. Where do your loyalties lie? That's the conversation next, 89.7 WGBH.
China's influence in American life may be at an all-time high, from buying companies in the Midwest to engaging Washington power brokers to inspiring rewrites of Hollywood blockbusters. As President Obama prepares to meet with Chinese leaders this week, we'll talk about how China is touching American lives in business and culture. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Wolf Greenfield, specializing in intellectual property law, supporting American Public Media's business and economic news show Marketplace, weekdays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH. And Simmons Leads, the premier resource for women's leadership and development, presenting the Encore Breakfast Series with Vernice Fly Girl Armor. Fly Girl is returning to Boston for a special three-hour seminar. More at simmons.edu/leadership.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It is coffee week at Boston.com, so naturally, they focused on the Hatfield McCoys of caffeine, maybe the 1%ers versus the 99%ers, Dunkin' Donuts versus Starbucks. And that's the Rorschach test of sorts. Do you drink Dunkin' or Starbucks? Give us a call and tell us which and why at 877-301-8970. And joining us to talk about how the Coffee Kings differ from business leadership to the way they market their brand is Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School. Her most recent book is about the great Ernest Shackleton, called Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nice to see you again, Nancy.
Always a pleasure.
All right, Nancy, I read the piece in the Globe, and you talked about the two very distinct different images of Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks. So what are those distinct images?
So Starbucks is, you know, an Italian coffee bar experience, or a coffee bar experience, you know, designed to be experiential, designed to be aspirational, designed to be very, very customized. Well, wait a minute, I'll come back to aspirational. Hang in there, Jim. So, and there's a very good market research on how people use coffee, not just to keep awake, not just because you like the flavor, particularly if you got lots and lots of sugar in your double D medium, but also, right, as a little reward. Right, I'm tired.
Yes.
It's been a long afternoon. I'm walking over and getting my beverage. But the most important, I think, differentiating aspect about Starbucks, and it's very much part of the brand, although it's not been mass advertised because Starbucks doesn't do that, unlike, you know, Time to Make the Donuts or America Runs on Dunkin', is that you come into a Starbucks, not only do you order your beverage exactly the way you want it, and they were the path breakers there in this market, but also, right, it is designed to be a place where you can meet and talk and hang.
Yes.
So get this. Starbucks is now the most popular place in America for offsite business meetings except for airport conference rooms because of telecommuting, something we talked about a couple of months ago when we were talking about Yahoo, and because it's just a place that all kinds of people, unemployed, employed, moms, you know, stay-at-home moms, teenagers, can hang. So the whole idea, and this was at the beginning, was about creating your own community for as long as you want on your terms in Starbucks.
See, I think, why don't you leave one thing out, which is, aren't people trying to make a statement in addition to what they like in terms of the coffee?
Absolutely.
You want to make a statement. In certain crowds, you can only go in with a Starbucks cup in your hand. And in certain crowds, you can only go in with a Dunkin' cup in your hand. No
question. No question with both. They're different statements, back to the different images, but no question. And people take great pride. This is why I think customers love or hate one or the other, right? And there's not a lot in the moderate middle because, you know, what you're holding, and this is true of all great brands, in your hand in terms of a cup, says something, just like what you're wearing or what you're eating or what car you're driving says something about you. So people are choosing to signal that, Jim. Absolutely. And it's a different signal. Quite a bit.
Yeah.
If you're choosing the Dunkin' Donuts styrofoam cup or if you're choosing the Starbucks recycled paper cup.
Okay, so wait a second. Let's do stereotyping here for a minute. There's this woman, Nancy Kane. She's from the Harvard Business School. She writes books and lots of articles. Let me see. You're a Starbucks drinker.
I'm a Starbucks girl.
Now, is it because of the status, or you want to say it's because you like the quality of the coffee?
Well, I love the coffee.
Tell the truth,
and they've turned me into a total coffee princess, right?
Yeah.
I just had a fight with a waiter in a restaurant in Harvard Square last night about don't mess with me. It better be really good coffee or I'm going to make your life a living hell. So they've turned me and lots of Americans, because now Dunkin' is a place where you can customize your drink and get lots and lots of different kinds of things just the way you want it. They've turned me into a coffee princess. I like the coffee, but I also like the ambiance of the stores.
Me too.
I really like it. I like walking in. It's familiar, but each store is a little different. I like the... You know, to be really honest, I really like how they treat their employees. And for someone like me who studies the guts of companies, the way they treat their employees from the get-go has always been, you know, just so far ahead of the curve and so decent relative to most retailer fast food that I have a warm spot in my heart for how they do their business.
What, like, for example, what have they done that, that puts them in the...
From the get-go. So from the very beginnings of the company, when Schultz bought the small coffee company in Seattle, they pay their employees, if you work 20 hours a week, all health, dental, and related
they
benefits.
Do.
Wow.
So one of the reasons people want to work at Starbucks is if you're working part-time or you're an artist or you're a student, here's a great way to get your health insurance. They are incredibly good about training their people or developing their people. That's something that doesn't really happen in retail. It does at Starbucks, right? They're incredibly good about providing employee stock options, what they call bean stock. So if you've worked there a while, you can collect a whole bunch of money that you can use for a house or a car, or your kids' education.
How about Dunkin'? How do they compare on that front?
See, Dunkin' doesn't have much of that. I mean, there's access to pet insurance. There's access to free product. But it's a much more typical—
Pet insurance?
Yeah, pet insurance.
You mean for your dogs and your cats?
Yeah, I don't think they give it to you, but I think they have a group rate. So that's kind of interesting.
That's sort of
interesting. Marge is going to look for a job over at the local
Dunkin'. But here's the key difference. Not only are they not in the progressive camp, and by the way, Dunkin' Donuts is much more typical of retail companies and fast food companies than Starbucks. Yeah. Starbucks is an outlier, right? They're very different. But Dunkin' Donuts is franchise. So remember, these are two very different animals. Almost the vast majority of Starbucks, now almost 20,000 outlets, cafes around the world, the vast majority are company-owned. Those that aren't company-owned, meaning Starbucks from Seattle, right, runs those companies, outfits them, right, has a hiring infrastructure that hires their people. Those that aren't company-owned are all licensed, but they're joint ventures. They're not franchised. There is no franchising at Starbucks. So think about that. That means at Dunkin's, where almost every store, not quite every store, but almost every store of their 13,000 outlets, most of which are in the United States, is franchised. So that means that what happens inside the store is much more dependent on the franchisee, mm-hmm. the person or the manager that he or she designates, than it is at Starbucks, where everything is company-owned and the policies and energy, even the music, right, has, you know, a kind of consistency to it that is only possible when you own the entire value chain as they do.
And so if you're a franchisee at Dunkin' Donuts and maybe you pick up two or three or four franchises, yep. you can make yourself a nice little living.
Just like those Coke bottlers, you bet you can.
Yeah.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking to Nancy Kane, and we want to talk to you, which is yours? Are you a Starbucks or are you a Dunkin' Donuts person? And we don't want to just know which. We want to know why you choose what you choose.
What's the email, Jim?
BPR.
At WGBH.org.
That is exactly right.
Christopher just emails and he says he talks about the smugness at Starbucks that he doesn't like versus the help at Dunkin' Donuts, whom he says call him hun. All the time.
You know what I was shocked by? One of the articles in the Boston.com thing. Did I read this right? There are only 200 Starbucks in Massachusetts. I mean, I live in Cambridge, and you almost can't turn a corner without seeing a
Cambridge.
Starbucks. Is that what it is? I mean,
Dunkin' Donuts, in relative terms, in terms of the numbers, Dunkin' Donuts is much more heavily concentrated in parts of New England than Starbucks is.
1,100 to 200 in Massachusetts, according to Boston.com, which is pretty dramatic.
That's a pretty big difference. But if you go to New York, for example, there are well over 200, I believe, in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And that's much more than there are in Dunkin' Donuts. Or if you go to California, where Dunkin' Donuts is just slowly now moving in, or in the Northwest, right? Starbucks is much more prevalent. So there's a geographic distribution that's sort of evolved mm-hmm. in the company's different expansion strategies.
Have you met Schultz, by the way?
I know Howard Schultz.
And it seems to me, I want to be, since I haven't met him, a little full of himself. Is that a fair statement or no?
I think that's quite unfair. He's one of the most humble and down-to-earth CEOs I have ever encountered or studied.
Wow.
Shut up, Jim. So let's just recall that Howard was born in Canarsie, Brooklyn, right? Spent his childhood in federally subsidized housing projects. His father held a whole bunch of jobs from which he was often laid off, drove a diaper truck, did all kinds of stuff. So one of the reasons Howard says today, and I really believe it, knowing him, I've been studying him since 1995 and interviewed him many times, one of the reasons he set up health insurance from the get-go is he said, what happened to my father isn't going to happen to my employees.
Good for him.
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, Howard figured out, before Harvard Business School folks, all of us had figured out this whole idea about service management and treating your employees like your best customers so they treat your best customers like they're really good people and build loyalty, Howard figured out that if you offer you know, a good wage, great development, career opportunities, because it's all company owned. You do well, and as a barista, you become a store manager. Then you get to district. Then you get to regional. Want to come to Seattle? I have met so many people that started as baristas, have been there 13 years, and they're now executives. But here's what we figured out.
Maybe I should withdraw that question.
Well, but it's really interesting. It's progressive. It's progressive.
So, killing you, Jim.
No, but all right. So you give these people, your baristas, your partners, as they call them. You give them health care benefits. And then, first of all, they want to work there. Secondly, they don't turn over as fast. And turnover is enormously expensive,
sure, right,
for any kind of retail establishment. So they have lower turnover rates by some measure that I don't know about Dunkin' Donuts, but say then McDonald's.
Okay. Nancy,
okay, so he's a good guy.
Now, one last thing before we get to the calls, even though you've totally humiliated me in the last 60 seconds.
No, last thing from my mind.
I am a huge fan of yours, but it's hanging in the balance with this question. When you go into Starbucks, do you actually say the word venti, or do you say small, medium, or large?
Okay, so we have to go back to once upon a time when I walked into my first Starbucks in 1994 in Seattle, and I was out there visiting a friend, and I thought, this is really interesting. I'm going to write the Harvard Business School case about it. Came running back, eager, over-caffeinated by nature rather than coffee, and my advisor said, you're nuts. You got to write about a real industry like turbines. And I had struggled with the language. I didn't really know what a latte was, even though I'd once been to Italy and spent time there. And then I learned, and now, like, you know, I've got it on my phone. I have the Starbucks app on my phone. Right?
I know exactly what I want.
I just do the whole thing, and it's part of my routine.
What do you want?
Pardon?
I actually drink
a COD, coffee of the day. If it's the morning, half calf, half decaf, because look, we all know I need no more coffee.
Okay, what do you say about size? Answer the question, Nancy King.
I usually say a tall, which is their
small.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. 877-301-8970. What's your preference and why? Nancy Kane is with us for this conversation. Let's start in Newton, where Suzanne is on with Nancy Kane, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. How are you?
Excellent.
Good. This is a great conversation. I am a coffee-aholic.
That's three of us. Four of us.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so, yes, we all know who we are. It's like a real club, you know? And so, well, here's the deal. I love hearing what Nancy just said about Starbucks and all those benefits.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, they're so good, Suzanne.
I was going to say that I find Starbucks, like, embarrassing. I just find it so embarrassing. Because it's all, I mean, it's getting better. But still, everybody that's in there, oh, we love Starbucks, and they have their little cell phones, and they're texting, and it's ridiculous. It's like, if you want to go and find the most embarrassing people, I don't know a better word for it.
So where do you go?
The iPads.
Where do you go? To Pete's? Yes. Where do you go then, okay, Suzanne?
But, yes, because I don't like Dunkin' Donuts either.
Okay, I figured. I had a feeling,
But it's very watery, but it's gotten better. Like I was saying to the caller, the screen guy, that my sisters and I go on about this too. If I had to, like, pick me up a coffee, you know, and if I had to, I would go to Dunkin' Donuts because they have some dark roast and stuff. But what I do is I go to local places. Local, hello.
Suzanne, I need to get a PhD in this.
Yeah,
you're really good. You are serious. You're a serious aficionado, Suzanne. So just one note on this, because this local thing is really important.
Where I live in Newton, I mean, I'm in Newtonville all the time because I work in Newtonville. I mean, there's Starbucks, and then there's this place that used to be Taste, but now it's George Hollowell. And then across the street, there's the bakery, and then across the street from that is Bread and Chocolate. I mean, they really are.
Hey, Suzanne, Nancy's got a question for you.
I want to build on what you said, Suzanne, because it's really interesting. So, buy local. We all understand that. We all appreciate it. We all want to sign up for it. So,
right, just
remember, I'm the historian, just remember for 20 years, right after World War II, coffee consumption on a per capita basis was on a slow, unmistakable, steady decline. And then, right, and that continued all the way into the 90s, right? But
yeah,
and then Starbucks, which really you have to think of as the little like carrot in front of the racehorses, or it's the pathbreaker, it's the canary down the mine shaft. Starbucks begins to change the game. And lots of people, including Dunkin's, which didn't sell dark roast before Starbucks, figure out that coffee can be something different than what we grew up with in Maxwell House. And so remember when we used to order a cup of coffee and say, bring me a cup of coffee, end of sentence?
Yeah.
Right? And now it's like, can you make it a half calf, half decaf, non-fat milk, a little soy latte, et cetera. In any event, Starbucks did a very important thing here, because what it did was, by changing what we think of when we think of coffee, not only did it enable folks like Dunkin's, folks like Pete's, lots of other players to up the willingness to pay and raise their prices and increase their margins and change and vary their menu, it also, right, helped locals. So if you look at the number of local coffee shops in places where there is a Dunkin' or a Starbucks, because they build and expand the market, there tend to be more local coffee shops. So this is not a zero-sum game in the way that we think of big box stores killing Main Street merchants. It's not. Because these companies make you and I, right, love coffee more, and that means we go to lots more local places, so mom and pops thrive. So basically, this is a good picture.
Suzanne, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Lexington, where John is on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
I'm another voice for a local. I was thinking, when you guys were asking the question about Dunkin' versus Starbucks, it's kind of like you're thinking of going out to eat and you're wondering, you know, should we go to McDonald's or Five Guys? And there are so many other options in the world. One of my favorites is the Java Room in Chelmsford. And really beautiful, subtle place. Decorated perfectly. They have George Howell's terroir coffee. And it's
George Howell was the founder of the Coffee Connection ages ago. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Which Starbucks bought, by the way, in the mid-90s.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to go to the Coffee Connection back in, you know, when it was the Starbucks in Lexington. I go there less frequently now. Another thing is Dunkin' Donuts, I hope, never has music. Starbucks sometimes has good recorded music. The Java Room has, and the other coffee shops too around have has great live music. Although I'm outing myself here as one of the performers, Saturday nights and Friday nights and
very enterprising
Saturday, Sunday brunch. So, but it's, you know, it's good music. You can drink your coffee and listen to music, and it's just so much better than either of those choices.
Hey, John, that was a great call. Yeah. Thank you very much. Good luck playing this weekend. You know, it is true. You said it first, and then John added to it, Nancy Kane. The ambiance, the feel of the place is a huge part of it.
And just the idea of hanging, right?
You know, you feel like a more cool person. Yeah. I mean, you go into Starbucks and you sit there, and everybody looks sort of hip, and you know, a lot of young kids, and Dunkin's can be a little bleak.
But a lot of people, like Suzanne, recoil at that she
right,
kind
exactly.
of thing.
So it's
and
like,
they want the basic want kind of just sit down
they
with your
it.
Coffee and your paper.
Absolutely,
and, that sort of
and
thing.
There clearly is room for both, right? Because we are not. Interestingly enough, we are not close to hitting a saturation point in this country.
No, we're not.
Right?
But one of the big things between Dunkin' Donuts, they have the turbo now at Dunkin' Donuts, is there's more caffeine in the Starbucks coffee. So, you know, for people that are interested in that, I don't get much of a buzz from Dunkin' Donuts unless I go to the turbo. I definitely get a buzz from Starbucks. And that, to me, was the initial reason why I stopped going to Dunkin' Donuts.
877-301-8970. We're talking to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School about sort of the backdrop for the coffee wars between Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, and obviously some of the independents. Lisa, you're in Cambridge, and you're home with the three of us. Welcome. Hi, Lisa.
I am definitely a coffee achiever, and I have an opinion on this.
That's a great line.
I used to be a real big Dunkin' Donuts fan in terms of iced coffee, but once they went with the flavored, I can't step into the place anymore.
Because the smell, you mean, or the concept?
The smell of the tough. Like the hazelnut especially gives me a headache.
Oh, I'm with you. I hate it. I hate
terrible.
It.
And it's a shame because, you know.
So what are you doing as a coffee achiever, Lisa?
Well, I personally like my own coffee the best. But I would go to Starbucks, and I would love if we would have a Starbucks in North Cambridge on Mass Ave.
They hear that in Seattle.
Yeah, really. There's no good coffee. Some nice places, but they can't really make a good cup of coffee.
Lisa, don't go away, because you told one of our producers, you raised one other issue, which, as Marjorie knows, is near and dear to my heart, which is the receptacle in which the coffee comes. Make your point about that.
Yeah. The styrofoam.
Yeah,
is no good.
Yeah. I only offer small, even though I drink gallons of coffee a day, only order small from Dunkin' Donuts for that very reason, because it's the only size that comes in paper.
Do you need to two-fist it sometimes?
I do. I often do, but I can't drink out of – I can't have styrofoam touch my lips. Lisa, it's not just about the environment, it's the feel. Lisa, thank you so much for the call.
Let's go to Felicity calling from Newton. Hi, Felicity.
Hi.
Dunkin', Starbucks, or something else?
Starbucks.
Why?
And it's strange that you're having this program today, because just 3 days ago I was saying to my daughter that I have to write or call to Starbucks and tell them that teenagers go to Starbucks, buy their drinks, and then they take pictures of their drink, and they Snapchat them and email them or text them to each other. So I just think that says a lot about the status that having a Starbucks drink means to teenagers.
Nancy Kane is shaking her head up and down quite
powerfully. You know what one of the problems is with teenagers in Starbucks, though? They think that this is what you have to do. You can't possibly... Well, my kids, it's like, we have to go to Starbucks and get coffee. Well, I said, we have coffee right here, and I can make it, and we'll make the coffee. Oh, no. It's like it doesn't work for them unless they're going to Starbucks and getting a coffee.
So let's just deconstruct that for just a second. Put my brand, like, scholar's hat on, right? Well, one, it's back to identity, right? This is my drink. I'm a horse show. I'm a serious horse shower, and I horse show with a lot of teenagers. And you make a big mistake if you say to six teenagers, "I'm going to Starbucks. What would you like?" You're going to need two sheets of legal paper to get the order,
right?
Right, and you'd be very careful bringing it back because they're so specific about what they drink. It's their drink, and then of course you want to tell each other. Think about it: what drink you ordered, what it says about you, the photograph, and the list or the ingredients, and then you want to say, "Right, I decided this." So it's also about control and your own footprint, which is important to all of us and particularly important in certain ways when you're 14 or 16 or 18. So I think it makes very good sense. Again, I don't think that the folks at Starbucks ever saw that this would be the kind of meeting place or nexus that it's become for certain groups like telecommuters or teenagers. Now, one last thing. You're a parent. You have teenagers.
Right.
Where would you rather have them, right? I mean, Starbucks is a good, safe place for them to be after school. So I think that's important. But again, it speaks to us, and the ardency and the articulation of these fabulous call-ins tells us how important the ritual of coffee has become in our society.
Hey, Felicity, thanks for your call. Two things, Nancy Kane. First, I've heard that was his name Schultz? Is that his name?
Howard Schultz.
Is a fabulous, humble guy. Is that true? No. Okay. I've already blew that one. Do they, in their business meetings, do they target the drinkers of – do Starbucks people target Dunkin' Donuts? Dunkin' Donuts target Starbucks? So, or do they say the twain will never meet? Let's just expand the people who are our kind of crowd.
So – I think a couple of comments. First, a historical comment. So one of the interesting things about Starbucks is I don't think the folks, Howard and his team and lots of different folks have, been part of the leadership there over the last 10 or 15 years, thought until about 2007 a lot about the competition, partly because the big players, that's McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts, really weren't in it in the same way. And so a little bit like Secretariat in 1973 at the Belmont Stakes, there was no one behind them. Right?
Marjorie's favorite movie.
And one of the best horse races of all times, right?
The best.
Selma and Stakes,
so,
yes.
So no one behind them. Just like Secretariat coming around the clubhouse turn, no one behind the horse. And then beginning in 2006, 2007, I think Schultz will be the first to say we were arrogant, we were close-minded, we had blinkers on, we missed it. McDonald's gets very much into their McCafés and espresso and Dunkin' Donuts
and
starts
Newman,
offering
Paul Newman's coffee.
Paul
is their
Newman's coffee, Green Mountain,
yes,
right? And this whole new burgeoning world of competition in the space that Starbucks thought that they owned.
Yeah,
I mean, again, Howard will tell you we missed it. McDonald's put up a billboard saying paying $4 for a cup of coffee is dumb. Right, Dunkin' Donuts has a website in which you can order a T-shirt that says "Friends don't allow friends to drink Starbucks."
I love that.
So I would say that Starbucks, I think, is now much more mindful of the competition. If you think about the most important innovations they've made in drip coffee in the last 4 or 5 years, one is Pike's Place, which was a medium roast designed to appeal to folks that like turbo at Dunkin', and now Blonde, their light roast, which is definitely designed for folks that would prefer Dunkin'.
Yes, much lighter. That's why I don't like it.
I think Dunkin' has done exactly the same. Something with much more aggressive, if you will, aggressive and slightly nasty advertising. But think about what, the Dunkachino? Right, what's that about? That's about the Frappuccino. So, yes.
It's only got 7,000 or 8,000 calories, too. It's fabulous.
Right.
But, Nancy, you mentioned McDonald's, which I'm embarrassed to say we didn't include. I'm guessing They probably sell more coffee than either of these places.
I don't know the number of cups per day, but they are certainly up there.
Yeah,
think about how many outlets they have.
But does anybody go into – I mean, you go into Dunkin' Donuts and possibly only get a coffee.
And
you go into Starbucks and possibly only get a coffee. Does anybody go into McDonald's and say, I'll just take a coffee?
Yes, because it's a drive-through on the highway.
There's
a drive-through,
and a lot of McDonald's are open 24 hours. And remember, McDonald's has a huge, huge morning business.
Yeah, that's true.
So there, I'm sure. The answer is yes.
Speaking of Chelmser, which your prior caller was, Christine is on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and Nancy Kane. Hey, Christine.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, great discussion.
Thank
you. One that goes to McDonald's all the time.
Oh, perfect.
Because they have, they have Paul Newman organic coffee.
Yep.
And I do agree, and that's really a fine coffee, and you can ask for real cream. I don't know whether the one that they have, if they put it in for you, is real cream or not, but I ask for it on the side. And the other thing I wanted to say about this whole thing is I wish that they would let you bring your own cup, because, you know, in Nebraska, which is where I used to be, you could bring your own cup in.
Why do you want your own cup? I'm just curious.
Well, because you were talking about the styrofoam, and
what
you get at McDonald's.
That's a
styrofoam cup, and my kids are really bothered about the fact that I drink out
good
of
for
the
them.
Cup.
Christine, Nancy has a thought about the cup deal. What's that,
so
Nancy?
Christine, I couldn't agree with you more. And environmentally, it makes a lot of sense too. Is, you know, you can certainly at certain stores. I know at Starbucks stores, you can bring your own mug in. You can certainly bring a Starbucks mug if you bought a Starbucks, you know, traveler's cup, and they're delighted to fill it. They will sell you for $1 a plastic, you know, biodegradable cup that you can use over and over and over again. So there are certain solutions to this, but I couldn't agree with you more for all kinds of reasons, including we just like to drink our coffee out of the cup we like to drink it out of.
Yeah. You know, that does raise a good point. The Starbucks cups are not most of them biodegradable, right?
Oh, I believe that all their cups have a huge percentage of recycled materials in it.
Oh, they do.
No, I bet some riding boots on that one.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking to Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School, and we're talking about the focus this week. We have to give credit where it's due. Boston.com has been doing this this coffee week thing that has gotten us obsessed, because at least one of us, plus Nancy, is obsessed with coffee. Let's go to Nathan in Watertown. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim, Marjorie, and Nancy. Hey there.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a high school student, so naturally I go to get coffee a lot with all the work. And funny enough, the two coffee shops that are nearest to my school are Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks, and I've been hooked on Starbucks, and I go there probably twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, the thing that keeps me going to Starbucks is it's nice because they know you there, and it seems like your drink can be, you know, customizable, and they always are, you know, very centered around you, which, you know, is a little narcissistic for the customer, but it's, I think, nice to have.
Nathan, where do your parents go?
My parents go to Starbucks.
And does that have anything to do with your choice, or is it all an independent decision-making thing?
You know, I think it must have some influence on, you know, me. I probably went to Starbucks with my parents, and then that's how I, mm-hmm. you know, figured out that I liked it. But I generally, you know, don't go with them anymore, and it's just something that's, you know, part of our daily routine.
Nathan, what do you drink? What's your favorite Starbucks coffee drink or whatever? What's your favorite beverage there?
At Starbucks, I really like the light iced vanilla latte.
Uh-huh. I love this guy.
What size? What size, Nathan?
On a regular day, usually grande, but during exam week, which was last week, which I made note that the baristas knew that it was exam week, and they said, oh, happy exam week, hope you're doing well, I usually get a venti then.
Now, of your friends,
you mean business.
Of your high school friends,
yeah.
Nathan, who drink coffee, what's the rough split, would you say, between the Dunkin' Donuts and the Starbucks crowd?
You mean, like, how many people go? Which
percentage of your friends would you say? I know it won't be scientifically deduced. What percentage go to Dunkin's if they're doing a coffee, and what percentage go to Starbucks, like you?
I'd say 75% go to Starbucks and 25% to Dunkin's. But the thing about my school is I go to private school, so I don't know if that's a difference between, you know, you mentioned earlier, the kind of snooty idea of Starbucks versus the, you know, America runs on Dunkin' idea. of Dunkin' Donuts. So that could be a factor, too.
How snooty are you, Nathan?
Well, I went to public school my whole life. So
Hey, Nathan, well, that is a great, great call. Thank you. Do it again, Nathan.
It does cost more. It does cost
more. Well, so I did a little price comparison.
Right? What's your price comparison?
So it varies from store to store at Dunkin's because it's franchised, so they have a little more jiggle room. And of course, it varies in all with both coffee retailers. It varies by location, but a medium cup of coffee, cup of Joe, right? America runs on Dunkin'. Price varies from $1.49 to $1.69. At Starbucks, a medium, which is called a grande, is about $1.89. So, yeah, it's a little bit more.
Yep.
Now, when you start getting into the high labor, highly customized, higher margin drinks, right, like all these Frappuccinos.
Ice or caramel macchiato.
Dunkachino, or all the different flavor shots that you can have in Dunkin's, there's not much discernible difference.
You know, we are
really
getting
so?
Now. And wait, say one more thing. You have to remember that if we went back in time before Starbucks had kind of become a national chain, if we went back 10 years, we would find that the cost of a medium coffee at Dunkin' Donuts was substantially lower. Full stop. Why? Is it higher? But not. It's not because the cost of coffee has gone up in some straight line. It varies a lot, like lots of commodities. It's because we are all now willing to pay more at the lowest price points on up for coffee.
Yeah, let me add one more thing to the price point, as you describe it. We've had this. Marjorie and I do a few shows around Christmas time on tipping. Mm-hmm. And one of the conclusions I think we could reach, because I'm obsessed with that subject too, and we'll talk to you about that someday, is most people don't like tipping at fast food joints. Yeah. There's no expectation in most Dunkin' Donuts you tip. There is an expectation at most Starbucks that you tip. Does that have any impact on decision making?
That's interesting because
I don't think so. I find
the opposite, actually.
I don't tip at all, and I'm so loyal, right? Like I have auto restock.
You don't tip at all at Starbucks.
Yeah, once in a while, throw some
work?
Change in the thing.
Yeah,
but I don't think of that as part of my coffee price, and I don't necessarily do it.
Jim tips everybody. I mean, Jim chases the garbage, the trash collectors,
well,
I should say, down the street.
Well, I'm worried they're going to say something bad about me. Let's take one or two more calls for Nancy.
Just one second before we get the calls. I just want to mention that there's been a lot of people emailing about the food at Dunkin' Donuts, and people are, of course, talking about how much they like the donuts and some of the vegetable wraps and the, which are pretty good, I must say, when you get the croissant or the bagel with the egg and cheese, and the cheese is sort of melted in there. So you have those choices. Although, on the other hand, coffee cake at Starbucks is pretty good, not to mention the pound cake.
So just
the pumpkin
one
cake and the banana.
Let me just log in.
You know what Friday is, Ms. Historian of Business? You know what Friday is?
No,
speaking of
me.
Dunkin' Donuts, come on. National Donut Day.
Oh, yeah, I missed that.
Kane.
I don't eat donuts.
Okay, well, okay.
I eat red licorice and chocolate instead.
One
comment about the food. So, Starbucks has taken up the gauntlet of trying to improve their food in the last 3 or 4 years with great kind of diligence, because a lot of people say, great coffee, but I'll go get my bagel over here. I'll go get my donut over here. So they have, in the last 2 years, bought a French bakery, Boulange, which they're now going to roll out French pastries, and they have just made a much more concerted effort to up the quality. So we'll see. I think the jury's very much out on that.
I think it's good already.
God bless you. I'm sure Howard Schultz will be very glad to hear that. But you know, I think that that's another kind of, if you will, frontier that Starbucks wants to play on in a new way because of the crowding in the coffee landscape.
Have you seen the minis? They have the little teeny
tiny donuts. And lollipops.
Yes.
Lolly cakes.
So you can get
those.
Look
how happy all three of us are. It's incredible.
You don't want to go overboard.
Joy.
You know, just a little taste of sweet to go with your coffee. It's great.
We have time for one more call. I think Derek, you're in Nashua, New Hampshire. You're talking to the three of us. Hey, Derek, on Boston Public Radio.
Hi, Nancy, Jim, and Marjorie.
Hey there.
Hey.
So between Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts for the coffee, Starbucks if I want to sit and use Wi-Fi, but my favorite place is Bonhoeffer's in Nashua. I get the soy vanilla latte, and I listen to you guys, and I'm overflowing with joy like...
God bless you, Derek.
God, this guy is great.
You are truly enlightened in the caffeinated sense of the word.
By the way, Derek, thank you for a great call. I have to say, Nancy, you probably will not be surprised by this. We do a whole spectrum of topics on the show. When we have discussions about coffee, which are not that irregular, I should say, the level of passion and information is as high as anything. It is amazing how – I say this all the time, Marjorie – coffee is it's not just the coffee.
No.
It's surely not just the coffee and caffeine. It's the experience. It's the part of your life that coffee drinking becomes. Am I right or am I right, Nancy?
You are so right. And I think it's wonderful. I mean, because it gives us all a little pleasure, right? It gives us all something that we care very passionately about. That's part of, not like the holidays, it's part of every single day. It's fabulous.
You know, do I have time to ask Nancy a question about something we may or may not discuss later in the show that we were talked about asking her at the end?
Yeah, you can.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm just curious about this because you talked about branding around tragedies the last time you were here with us and the Komen.
Boston Strong stuff.
Boston Strong, yes. And the Komen race for the cures has been, or their 3-day march, I should say, has been canceled in many cities, including Boston. Komen started out with the pink ribbon thing, and the pinkness has always sort of bothered me as a female. I just wonder, as a Harvard Business School expert in this kind of stuff, what you think about the pink ribbon.
So I should also tell you that I'm a 2-time breast cancer survivor, so I logged in on this in two different ways, or in two powerful ways, right, at least. So I think we want – this is a great example. It's not true just for brands that have such emotionally sensitive associations like breast cancer, right, that touch so many. It's true for all great brands. I think the bottom line is you've got to handle this stuff with so much thoughtfulness and deftness and care and empathy. And the problem with what happened with the Susan Komen Foundation is they just went over the edge for a lot of different reasons. And so when you have something,
because of their stopping to fund Planned Parenthood's
exactly.
So, mammograms for low-income
exactly.
women, saying
so
it wasn't about politics.
Yeah, and there was some dubious stuff there.
Funding some bad products.
Exactly. I think it's less about the pink ribbon than about how do we want to handle something that represents a disease that 1 in 7 women will get, and that everyone is touched by, and that scares the bejesus out of everyone. I think it's about deftness and integrity and great care. And it's not clear that has been manifested or achieved in the instances you're talking about.
Thank you very much.
I was hoping you might say that. Nancy Kane is a historian at Harvard Business School, and her most recent book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Thank you so much for being with us
today.
I love it
talking to you. Okay, we are moving on to Brian McGrory, who is the editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock in open mic. We're going to talk a little Whitey Bulger and a bunch of other stuff. Brian McGrory, editor of the Globe, that conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
There's a new Whole Foods coming to Midtown Detroit. You ask around about it and they'll tell you. It's about time.
We should have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, stuff from around the world that you're not going to get at other stores. We need that.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The grand opening next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you. And New England College of Business and Finance, NECB, offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu. And Scott and Bailey, one is argumentative, the other a true diplomat. Together, these women solve Britain's most difficult crimes while battling personal demons. Scott and Bailey, Wednesday at 10 on WGBH 44.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan.
One of Boston's biggest trials is now underway.
It may be the most anticipated trial in recent memory.
This is going to be a fascinating trial. This story is just so layered. It's just so amazing.
This is the folklore of Boston, and forever it is known for that.
For some people it is, and for some people it isn't. We're going to take an informal survey here at 877-301-8970. Who is riveted to the Whitey Bulger trial and his decades-long grip in the city, and who couldn't care less? Marjorie and I think it may be a generational thing. Does No Country for Old Men apply to the Whitey Bulger enthusiasm index amongst younger Bostonians? Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. You don't have to tell us your exact age, but you have to tell us your generation. The Boston Herald sent out a reporter. We're going to play this for you in a couple of minutes. Sent out a reporter to talk to 20 and 30-somethings to ask what they knew about the Bulger thing. And I think it was mixed. But the level of excitement and interest is obviously dramatically different than it is for people who live through at least the legend of Bulger, if not the actual actions.
If you're not interested, it's because you don't know anything about it. That's my
theory.
Well,
that's actually
a pretty
good point.
It would be impossible for me to believe that if you knew about someone who allegedly killed probably 20 people, probably more. He's charged with 19, but there were more. You know,
including allegedly strangling two women to death with his bare hands.
Yeah, you knew about his double life with, you know, living with one woman and living with another woman and taking off with one woman and coming back with a different woman. I mean, you cannot be transfixed by this guy. Plus the fact that his brother, while he was the overlord, while Whitey Bulger was the overlord of crime in South Boston, his brother was the overlord of politics from South Boston and dominated the state house and dominated politics around here for a long time. So if you're not interested, it's because you're not paying attention.
I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, if you want to catch up, if you go to WGBHnews.org, some of the best summaries of the life and times of Whitey Bulger. It's fabulous.
The timeline. And it's just a fascinating, fascinating story.
877-301-8970. Again, just give us your generation if you don't want to tell us your specific age. And I couldn't agree with you more, Marjorie. It is one of the great stories. And it'd be a great story if it was a story. It's a 10 times better story because of the reality of it. When you hear some of the victims, survivors, who've been waiting forever, not only for this guy to be brought to justice, what was he, 16 years in San? How long was he gone? 16 years?
He left in 1995. So and he was 16
years.
Last year.
In, well, year before, I think, in Santa Monica. Yeah.
And how they caught him is also fascinating.
You mentioned, the one thing I'm so glad you mentioned, I forgot about. Tell the story briefly about him dropping off one girlfriend and then picking up the other when he starts his odyssey. That's a great little moment.
He clearly had a thing for blondes. The woman he had a child with, her last name was Cyr, C-Y-R. I think she was a brunette. He did have one child that died at 6 years old of Reye syndrome, you know, the thing that you get from aspirin. But after this, he began having this romance with a woman named Teresa Stanley, who both you and I saw when she was a waitress over at the convention.
At the convention center, yeah.
She has since passed away. Anyway, this gorgeous blonde, she had four kids, single mom, living over in the project. And he meets her, and they start this romance. And he would, come over to her house at night. He bought this beautiful house. He came over to the house at night, have dinner with her and the four kids, give all the kids advice. Wouldn't let them use the phone between 5 and 7. You know, if the phone rang, nobody could get it. They had to have this dinner hour. He's handing out all this advice about stay away from the wrong people. Irony of ironies. And then he'd leave her house and go off and do his crime life. And then somewhere along the line, he found somebody else, Catherine Grieg, who's two brothers-in-law were both murdered by Whitey Bulger. He starts a romance with another gorgeous blonde, Catherine Grieg. When it comes time for him to leave town, he leaves town. He flees with Teresa Stanley. They drive all across the country. But Teresa Stanley has got four children, a bunch of grandchildren. After a while, she says, I've had it with this life on the run. Drop me off. He brings her back to Boston, drops her off in one parking lot, and then goes up, picks up Catherine Grieg, makes her leave her twin poodles behind, and then he starts off on this odyssey around the country with Catherine Grieg.
And by the way, she's the woman who was found in the apartment in Santa Monica with, and now she's in jail, I think, for
eight years.
And by the way, if you're wondering whatever happened to Brian McGrory, we assume he's in line at Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts. We'll get to him in just a couple of minutes, the editor of the Boston Globe. But first, we want to know whether you're into this Bulger thing, which a lot of people are obsessed with, or if you're not. And if you're not, is it a generational thing? Let's start in Worcester with Ann. You're on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
I am obsessed with this. I'm going to be. And this will become my summer. I had my first date with my husband at Whitey's Bar, Triple O's, in South Boston. I never knew. I was from out of Boston, moved there, met him 6 months later, went out with a bunch of guys, went out with a bunch of everybody and drinking and blah, blah, blah. And he does the trying to impress me to pull the tablecloth out from under the glasses, only the tablecloth is plastic. so all the glass would shatter. He looks at me and says, okay, run. We got to get out of here.
That is now, a fabulous story. Go ahead, Ann. I'm sorry.
I had no clue. So I'm like, oh, yeah, we broke glasses. Okay, that's bad. We run. You know, what, 25 years later, I pick up the book Black Mass, and I'm interested because now I've lived around the Boston area. Pick up a book Black Mass and open the front cover, and isn't Triple O's there? And I called my husband at work. Isn't that the bar we were in? He said, absolutely. I said, did you know? He said, well, not really, but...
Wait a second. You never asked him why you were running out of the place?
What's that?
You never asked him why he said run?
Broken glass.
Yeah, I thought we broke the glass.
And?
But it was, you know, turns out it was pretty, and it was 1980, so.
That's great.
Yeah. And I may be mixing up my shady watering holes, but isn't Triple O's, now a sushi bar, isn't Triple O's the one they call the Bucket of Blood?
Isn't
Triple O's the bar that was nicknamed the Bucket of Blood because of all the mobsters hanging around in there? Or have I got my mooring holes mixed up? I think it is,
no,
right?
You got it. Exactly.
So,
and when I told my mother, she said, what? You married? I mean, it's a great story.
It's a great story. Ann, thanks for sharing it with us. We appreciate it. That is a great story. Let's go to Marlon.
In the car. Hi, Marlon.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent. Great. Thanks for the call.
Good. I think it's a fascinating story. Whitey Bulger's story is a fascinating story. You guys brought up all the salient points that make it a fascinating story. However, I think it's not just a generational thing. I think it's a native Bostonian thing. I'm a transplant. I'm 50 years old. I'm a transplant. I've lived here about 10 years. And to me, I'm following it, and it's interesting. And from a news standpoint, it's kind of cool. But I'm not obsessed with it the way people, I think, no matter their age, were born and raised here.
Grew up with it.
And it's kind of the Boston lore. And I think there's a lot of folks who wish we still Boston still kind of had that seedy reputation and, you know, the Irish mafia, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's not just generational, it's also where you lived.
Yeah,
that's a good point, I think, Marlon. Yeah.
But when you think about it, Marlon, I mean, Whitey Bulger was the number two on America's most wanted list, the FBI's most wanted list, top 10, for years until, of course, Osama bin Laden was killed. And that's when he moved from number two to number one. So this guy was number one on the most wanted, the FBI most wanted list. And there is, of course, the side saga of the corruption in the FBI, which, when you look into it, is just horrifying, because what these agents would do, people that were afraid they're about to get killed by Whitey Bulger would call the FBI in desperation and say, look, at this mobster's after me. I'll trade information for you so you know you can put me in the witness protection or whatever. And what happened is these people, unbeknownst to them, would be going in to John Connolly, the exact agent that was the stool pigeon that was feeding everything to Whitey Bulger.
Who's now in jail for life in
Florida. And Connolly would then go tell Whitey Bulger, you know, so-and-so just came in to squeal on you. And then what would happen? Whitey Bulger would go out and kill him. I mean, it's just incredible, the corruption.
Hey, Marlon, thanks for the call. Which gets back to the point that Peter Galzinis made. We talked to him yesterday about the columnist from your paper interviewing the son of that murdered Hilai guy.
Roger Wheeler.
Who said, you know, fine, that Bulger's on trial. Why isn't the FBI on trial? And while there are the Connollys, the Morrises, the others who've paid a price, the institution, it's true. It's sort of like in the words of the great Peggy Lee song, is that all there is? I mean, obviously it's important for there to be consequences and then some for Bulger, but you feel that the government institution that perpetrated this thing or at least enabled this thing is really getting off scot-free.
Jim, the FBI was involved in the killing of a possibly unarmed man down in Orlando, Florida, that was associated with the Marathon bombers. Has the FBI told us yet what the heck was going on down there?
See, yesterday the Civil Liberties Union, though, which you are not a fan of, all the time asked for an investigation into that situation.
Well, good for the American Civil Liberties Union, because there should be an investigation. Let's go to Doug in Attleboro. Hi, Doug.
Hey, good afternoon, Marjorie.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call. What's going on?
I used to be in the draft beer installation and service business up until 2002, and I was in a lot of the joints that Whitey was alleged to have been hanging out in, including Triple O's down there in Southie.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And
do you ever threaten to kill you, Doug?
Excuse me?
You ever threaten to kill you?
Oh, no.
That's good.
No, but the company is a small company. I was with subcontractors for some of the larger beer and liquor distributors, and whenever they had a problem with their product or with a draft beer system somewhere, they would send us out to troubleshoot and get things back up and running. And A lot of the locations were in and around South Boston, the South End, Roxbury, the North End, you name it. The company went there, and I was one of their troubleshooters.
And so you're into this, correct? Because you
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you live part of it.
The baby boom generation, 1949.
Yeah, we got it. Hey, Doug, thanks for the call. You know, we mentioned earlier that the Herald sent a report out, and my apologies, I don't know the name. I went to the website to shoot a video with 20 and 30-somethings they found in downtown Boston saying, who is Whitey Bulger? Just get a feel for this. Let us play just a tad of it.
Whitey Bulger is, he was a gangster in the 80s who ran, he was down in Charlestown, wasn't he?
Not really sure, actually. I assume he killed some people.
Oh, he's back from the North End Italian mafia families.
He had some bad dealings with some bad people, and that things turned out bad for him where he was on the run.
I do not know who Eddie Bulger is.
That, you know, he was a gangster, you know?
No.
I'm assuming a lot of murders, that sort of thing. Something dirty. So.
And from the 70s?
It's a little delay, isn't it?
Well, they just finally caught him.
Oh.
Yeah. Well,
oh, good job.
Yeah.
I believe that is our videographer, very great videographer, Bob Grime, doing the
whoever it is, did a great job.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, in all fairness, to some people who are young, who had lived through it or maybe moved here to go to college, the level of knowledge was not wildly deep, but there was some of that there. So in any case, we're going to keep following it. We know we have reporters in the courtroom every single day.
Yeah.
And you're going to be hearing from them like crazy.
And you know how it was covering Watergate in that summer? I wasn't covering it then, but watching Watergate on television when the hearings came out. This is what it's going to be like. It could be like a Watergate 2 sort of deal.
Oh, when the testimony begins.
A parade of mobsters coming in to testify in that courtroom. Okay, this time, Brian McGorry actually is going to come up. We're going to be joined in just a couple of seconds by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGorry. We're going to do a little Whitey talking with him and a bunch of other stuff. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7. WGBH.
There's a new Whole Foods coming to Midtown Detroit. You ask around about it, and they'll tell you it's about time.
We should have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, stuff from around the world that you're not going to get at other stores. We need that.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the grand opening, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and New England College of Business and Finance. NECB offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu. And Scott and Bailey, one is argumentative, the other a true diplomat. Together, these women solve Britain's most difficult crimes while battling personal demons. Scott and Bailey, Wednesday at 10 on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Joining us on Open Mic, as he does every Tuesday, is the editor of the Boston Globe, whom we're told is all decked out in Bruins black and gold today. I'd love to see that, Brian McGorry.
I am jumping up on the Zamboni so fast, it's almost scary, you know?
I'd like to see that, Brian. That'd be kind of fun. Hey, you know what else I'm wondering about? We just talked about the Whitey Bulger phenomenon being sort of a generational thing that a lot of young people don't know who he is or what this is all about. But us oldsters, you know, the baby boomers and older, we know all about it. How much do you have to think about that in terms of play in the paper? And you guys have been doing a lot of great coverage, but does that factor into your thoughts about placement of these stories?
It does a little bit. I mean, look at the trial of Whitey Bulger and the story of Whitey Bulger is largely about a city that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it really doesn't. The Boston that Whitey Bulger tread over, that's just not what we have here now. But that doesn't mean it's not a fascinating narrative, because it is. It's a bit of history. It's a bit about our old culture. And let's face it, it's a really, really interesting drama that's unfolding before us. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think his trial is searingly relevant to what we have today in this city, but it's still a really interesting story, and for the people who are directly involved, the victims' families and the like, a very important one.
Oh, I am so with you. I don't know how you can't. This guy is alleged to have killed at least 19 people, probably many more. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. My colleague Peter Gozanis had a great piece talking about a different city, the triple O's, the bucket of blood. You know, they were
That was a great column he did on the front page the other day. It was really terrific.
Oh, I'll tell him you said so. But now Triple O's is a sushi bar. I mean, it's just, and that whole area of the waterfront that was just such a dump years ago is now so chic. I mean, you can hardly stand it when you get down there. And also, your colleagues have written great books. Dick Lehr, Jerry O'Neill, Shelley Murphy, Kevin Cullen. Great books on these on the life and times of Whitey.
The four of them, Dick and Jerry, who wrote Black Mass. Black Mass is obviously a runaway bestseller, had a terrific book out earlier this year. Both former Globe staffers, both
yep.
former Spotlight team members. And it, as you well know, it was the Spotlight team back in quite a while ago that broke the story that Whitey Bulger in the late 80s was a federal informant. For all we know, we wouldn't know that now if the Globe didn't break that story. And Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen have written a New York Times best-selling book that came out earlier this year that's also just flat-out terrific.
You know, one of my favorite pieces, everybody's got a favorite piece of the story. One of my favorites is the Shelley Murphy, the antipathy that Bulger feels towards her, which was spelled out in one of the letters that was in their book, the Murphy-Cullen book, that he had written to his former Alcatraz housemate, I guess, for lack of a better expression, that Sunday guy, in which he said that Shelley Murphy was the word that rhymes with bore and those kinds of things and worse, and that she was a total ingrate because he said that he had done a favor for her father, theoretically had protected him in a certain setting. And she never got to ask her father about this because he died. But it turns out, as she told me yesterday, is that he was a Korean veteran and he met Flemmy, who was also a Korean veteran.
Rifleman.
And that at one of these events, the 50th anniversary of some part of the Korean War, Flemmy wanted to bring a guest, and the guest he brought to the event was Jimmy Bulger. It's unbelievable. I have to say, Brian, though, my favorite Globe stories of the last couple of days are not Bulger, but they're Berlewitz. This is, for those, we talked about this earlier, she's the $600,000 a year head, for now, of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Boston. Yesterday and today, your guy Todd Wallach wrote of the misrepresentation of her doctorates. It may, it turns out, be a crime. The response of Ray Howell, former Weld guy spokesperson, was that it was gossipy, irrelevant, and sexist. What's the over-under on how long this woman lasts, Brian McGorry?
Look, you know I'm not going to get into that, Jim, but I will say isn't it an incredible story to read? I mean, Todd Wallach has done fantastic work on
Great.
It. Scott Allen has been his editor. Just fantastic. This head of the organization, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Leslie Berlewitz, she has been, according to our stories, reviled for a long time by many of her staffers over there who, according to these staffers, she verbally abuses over there. It's, it's been quite something to chronicle. Alex Beam has done a couple of columns on
her. We read those columns
this
morning.
They're a riot. Earlier. How I miss Alex Beam.
Hey, did you ever... go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You know, one of the things, as I mentioned in Todd Wallach's story today, and I hope Coakley goes further with this, we've had this discussion with the Attorney General on many occasions. She's in charge of charities or nonprofits, and the reason it's relevant is because when a woman makes $600,000 a year to run a tiny little nonprofit and takes first-class airlines or first-class seats on jets paid for by her nonprofit, all that stuff is subsidized by taxpayers. Obviously, they are, they're tax-exempt organizations. That to me is a huge issue that doesn't get nearly enough attention, these exorbitant salaries and benefits for nonprofit heads.
Oh, it's an enormous issue. They're getting taxpayer dollars, many federal grants, they're getting philanthropic dollars that could be better spent. And, as we saw in the story, she is flying first class and she's getting paid just a hair under $600,000 a year. And Todd Wallach, the Globe reporter, did an extraordinary job benchmarking what other people make who preside over organizations of her size in the philanthropic world and with her budget. And it there's nothing comparable. There's nothing comparable that we could find.
She is quoted. I'm surprised Wallach missed this today. I don't mean to disparage him. She is quoted as saying, "Your series on Ted Kelly at Liberty Mutual is what inspired her to that $600,000 salary." How do you feel about that, Brian?
Once again, Marjorie, I don't know how you put up with it day in, day out.
Maybe it's not true. Okay, forget it.
Okay. Thank you.
But, you know, Brian, I am not comparing you at all, obviously, to Ms. Berlowitz, who as Beam talked about, her employees were meeting every 3 weeks to complain about it.
I have no idea where we're going with this. Where are you going with this, Marjorie?
I'm wondering, now that you are the boss, I mean, I've never been the boss of anything, but now that you're the boss of the Boston Globe, don't you sometimes wonder, maybe in your paranoid moments, you know, what they're really saying about you out in the newsroom that you never hear, because when you get to be the boss, nobody tells you anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Jim, help me out here.
No, neither of us are helping you with anything. Hey, Marjorie's obsessed with the Suzanne Bump audit the other day that was covered in both papers. But you have an angle, Marjorie, that particularly moves you.
You have written a lot of brilliant columns about Deval Patrick, and I am fascinated by Deval Patrick's response to Suzanne Bump. She's a state auditor. People don't know that she discovered a lot of very bad record-keeping in the Department of Transitional Assistance, used to be called the Welfare Department, that, you know, money was going to people, 1,000 people that were dead and stuff like that. Deval Patrick is very prickly about this, and I wonder what you think, Brian. I know that he grew up in welfare for at least part of his childhood. Maybe that's it or what, but he, you know, the Herald is documented, and Suzanne Bump is documented further, just a mess up over there, and yet he doesn't seem to want to, he's in denial to some degree about it.
I'm of two minds on it, Marjorie, and you guys have done good and exhaustive work on the EBT card issue. I mean, part of me understands what Deval is saying, and that is it's a fraction of the budget that we're spending. And, you know, much of the money is well spent. It helps people get a leg up who really need it, helps people get through tough times. And I understand all that, and I think that relates to his own childhood, and the help he got from the government was very important, and it led him to a very successful and prosperous life. On the other hand, I think what he doesn't fully grasp is when he dismisses it as easily as he does, it just shows that perhaps he's not paying as strong, or he's not as focused on the details of the government and the budget and the spending patterns as he perhaps should be, because people will take the money that is being misspent here and extrapolate that if the governor doesn't care that this money is going to dead people or this money is being abused by welfare recipients, then what else doesn't he care about? And I think to quote a, you know, kind of the word of the moment, the optics don't work for him when he is dismissive, when he is as dismissive as he is.
Let's talk about one of the optics. I mean, I do agree with both you and Marjorie. The fact that he experienced this, lived on it himself, I think speaks to his concern about demonization of poor people who accept welfare benefits. But the flip side is, in the X number of years, 6 years, whatever it is, that he's been governor, I've never seen him respond this way to a fellow Democrat. He was asked the question, Suzanne Bump is not just a Democrat, the auditor. She served in Deval Patrick's cabinet earlier in his term. He was asked the question about, do you think she's doing a bad job as auditor? And he basically said he'd reserve decision, questioned her numbers in a pretty heavy-handed way, which suggests to me that while he is everything that you and Marjorie are talking about, he's also savvy enough to know that there's a political cost associated with this, no?
Yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, keep in mind the overall personality traits of the governor, who's, you know, generally a very congenial guy. I mean, I think we all agree. You guys spend an afternoon, an hour, a month with him, correct?
Yeah,
we do.
He's very
nice
charming.
Guy,
but the governor, when cornered or when facing a sharp disagreement, can sometimes be a little bit different. And I think that's what we're seeing here right now.
Well, you know what the other thing that occurred to me, and your Basic Black, which airs every Friday night at 7:30 on WGBH here, they talked about this last week, the whole stereotype of the Black welfare recipient. And I wonder whether that's part of it, too. Obviously, Deval Patrick is an African-American, and even though many more white people get welfare than Black people, there is this lingering stereotype that the welfare queens, that they're all Black women and they're not white women kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, look at it. There's a certain element of pop psychology here and putting the governor on the couch, and I think it's always a little bit dangerous to do that. But
I love to do it, Brian, I must admit.
I know, so do I, but I just... there's a certain danger to doing that here. It is a complex issue for him. There is no doubt in my mind it's a very complex issue for him. So he's got a lot of competing factors going.
You know, I want to turn to something. You guys have been doing this series. We talked about a piece of it earlier called, is it Broken City? Is that what
yes.
it's called about Washington?
Yeah, Broken City,
yeah. The most recent thing, it happened a couple of weeks ago. We didn't have time to talk to you about it. I don't know who wrote the piece about this guy, Nolan, who was a congressperson from Minnesota, took 32 years off to become a farmer, and he just went back to...
Rick Van Winkle is what his nickname is in Washington, yeah.
Why? Because he was gone for 32 years?
Exactly.
I like that.
In Congress, he left for 32 years, and he came back, and he arrived in a completely different place.
Yeah, and he talks about the dysfunction of the institution. He does it pretty eloquently. And then, a month or so before, one of your people did a profile on how this disabilities treaty died that Bob Dole, former United States Senator, was behind. Now Bob Dole is on, I think he was on Fox even, that says the Republican Party should hang a sign up till Christmas saying close for repairs till they get their act together. When I read these things, I feel great because I say that people of some prominence actually are honest enough about how pathetic Congress is. But then I say to myself, is there any impact at all from these stories? I know there's impact on real people who read them and shake their heads like I do and readers do, but there's no evidence this has any impact on people in power. Is there?
No, but perhaps, Jim, that we don't have to have impact on people in power, because if we have impact on average people, the way you change the situation is on election days. And we do have those election days, and we have them every 2 years. And ultimately, if you're not going to get the people in authority in Washington, specifically on Capitol Hill, to reengage, refocus, basically reboot what it is they're doing, then it's up to the people to decide: do we really want them there anymore? And we're going to continue with this Broken City series. We've got a couple of other pieces in the works that look at different ways that Washington is broken that affect elections and whatnot, and get into the administration a little bit as well as Capitol Hill, but. We don't expect at all we're going to change the mindset of those that are already there. The ultimate question is, will the people who choose who's there take action on this?
We're talking with Brian McGrory, who's the editor of the Boston Globe, and many people may not know this, that in his spare time he writes books, and one of them is a great book, Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. Now, I want to ask you, Brian, because I know you don't write the editorials, but you had a great editorial on the Globe today about this bear that was murdered, I would say, by
murdered.
Environmental police when he climbed
assassinated,
up and...
Assassinated, Marjorie. Assassinated.
Yeah. What do you make of it? I mean, you're a dog lover. You actually warmed up to a rooster, so I know you must feel terrible about this bear.
Look, you know I'm not supposed to express my opinion on this stuff. I'm supposed to be very, very neutral and all that. I'm not...
However.
I can't get my head around it. The bear was up in a tree. The bear was not posing a direct threat to anybody. The bear got lost and went someplace where he shouldn't have gone. We have the ability to capture the bear by tranquilizing him, by putting him in a truck, by setting him loose in a wooded area where he belongs. And they did that exact same thing in New York, I think the day after. There was a good story in the New York Times.
Time, so, yeah.
Efforts to round up a lost bear and tranquilize him and bring him elsewhere. And this is like a bad Leslie Nielsen movie where the bear is up in a tree and some gung-ho cop just says, let's shoot him in the head. And the thing comes tumbling down on the railroad tracks. It's unacceptable. It really isn't.
Yeah.
First of all, there's no such thing as a bad Leslie Nielsen movie. Let me just say that.
Actually, you know what? I am so glad you corrected me on that. John Candy and Leslie Nielsen are two of the greatest cinematic actors of all time.
But don't you notice, Brian, how you can write a tragic tale about a human being and it's terrible and you write a tragic tale about an animal, you get about 9,000 times the response in the newspaper should do to the person. I don't know what that's about, but
because they're defenseless. They can't defend themselves.
I guess that's true. Hey, one last thing. We were talking about this a little while ago, and I'm dying to know, Brian. Because
it comes from Boston.com because it's Coffee Week Boston.com.
That's right. It's a Coffee Week at Boston.com, and you guys had a great interview with the woman we also spoke to, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, about Dunkin' Donuts versus Starbucks. Now, can you reveal to us here? I know that this could be putting you on the spot,
Brian. He's going to say he loves them both.
Are you a Dunkin' man or a Starbucks man?
Jim, give me a little more credit than that, would you please? I mean, for God's sakes, would you just let me be me just for one
minute? Let me give Brian's answer before Brian does. When I'm on my way to the Bruins game tonight, I'm going to have a Dunkin' Donuts. But when I'm sitting on Newbury Street celebrating the victory, I'm going to have a cafe latte from Starbucks.
Maybe
is that the answer?
The pretty waitress place that got in trouble for having all the pretty waitresses down on the South Shore. And went, what's that called? Carol Ann's or Candy Ann's?
Whatever it is. So what's your answer? I'll let you speak for yourself. Go ahead.
My answer is, as the editor of the Globe, I have to remain completely I'm unable to offer any sort of response to your question as much as I appreciate what you're asking.
Oh, I'm upset.
That is really pathetic.
You know, it is a dilemma, because on the one hand, you're really supposed to be, you know, a hard-bitten Dunkin' Donuts person around here. On the other hand, you can't compare the ambiance of the Starbucks. You know, I feel as though you have to go in there with your iPad or your Mac computer. You just
or
can't go
beret.
In there with a trashy Toshiba laptop. You know what I mean, Brian?
I will say one of my favorite columns that I ever wrote was about the Dunkin' Donuts on Boylston Street near Exeter, and how the owner of that Dunkin' Donuts got these people working the counter who would basically stay there for 10, 15, 20, 25 years, and they knew everybody's order the second they saw them. I mean everybody. And it was just... It was a delightful thing to see from a kind of regular consumer's point of view. The second you walked into that Dunkin' Donuts, they knew exactly what you wanted.
That's pretty good. The baristas, the turnover.
I think that's our answer.
The turnover.
I don't think the baristas are quite as attentive to everybody who walks in.
I'd leave it there if I were you, Brian McGrory. Brian McGrory, no. Editor of the Boston Globe. We'll talk to you next week, Brian. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, Marjorie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Tomorrow we have open mic with Christopher Lydon. I think we're going to be doing a little Whitey Bulger talk with Christopher Lydon.
So.
Up next, the Writers Guild released its list of 101 best written TV shows. We're going to take stock of what deserves this high honor and what was woefully left out. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH for that conversation.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Stonebridge at Burlington, who believe assisted living should provide choices such as art classes, a full-service spa, and a cafe. If you agree seniors deserve to live well and love life, you can find Stonebridge at nextgenerationseniors.com. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, featuring a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and a former spy. More info at bostonspeakerseries.org. Media support from WGBH and Dedham Savings. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, striving to provide patients with expert cancer care, innovative services, and treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
Still my heart. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy and she is Marjorie, and you know what that is. We're talking about a list you can talk about forever. It's 101 best written television shows announced yesterday by the Writers Guild of America. And you know, in a rare moment where Marjorie and I not only agree, but are right about something, our number one, had we put together the list, is actually the number one of the Writers Guild. We want to know what your number one would be, and we'll tell you if it made the top 10. We'll play some sound from some of the great and beautifully written television shows. This is ever, by the way. They go back to practically the beginning of television. Our number is 877-301-8970. What's the best written television show ever? Maybe not your favorite show, but the best written show. Why are you smiling?
Because we already have a nomination.
What is it?
From Stephen.
What is it?
Broadside.
The News with Jim. I love that. It's brilliantly written. Know. John Minskoy,
brilliantly
my producer,
written. That's
is
correct.
Unbelievable.
You're not on the list. I'm sorry
you.
To report.
It is disgraceful. 877-301-8970. They go back like 70 years. They pick 101 of the greatest shows. By the way, some are comedies, some are dramas. Most of them are from, I didn't do an actual calculation, but I think it's safe to say most of them, would you agree, are from the last 10 years or so? There's some comedies that are a little bit older, but most of the dramas seem to be pretty either current or relatively recent.
Yeah, there's only one that I remember when I was a really little girl, and it was a really good kind of scary show. One of the top ones was a really scary show that I watched when
I was say what
girl.
It was. What is it?
The Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone. In fact, can we play? Do we have a little sound from The Twilight Zone? Do we or don't we? I can't tell we do. The Twilight Zone and Rod Serling. Here it is.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into The Twilight Zone.
Gives me chills, too. This is unbelievable. We're going to take your calls at 877-301-8970. We're also joined on the line by Bob Thompson. He's the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Rod Serling, by the way, creator of Twilight Zone, born right here in Syracuse, New York.
Is that true?
Really?
1924, Christmas Eve, if I'm not mistaken.
You remember it like it was yesterday, Bob.
Yeah, that's
perhaps
right, when Rod and me used to play sandlot baseball together.
Yeah, or maybe Syracuse is what made him so weird, Bob. I don't know.
Well, he moved down to Binghamton, New York.
That's what did it.
Hey, Bob, you saw this list. Is there anything that didn't – we haven't told people what the top 10 is yet. We're going to. Anything that didn't make the top 10 where you shook your head and said, are they kidding?
You know, I think this is a really solid list. I went down this 101, and a good portion of them I play at one point or another in my three-semester-long history of television course. So all the ones that I think had to be on that list somewhere ended up being there, with one possible exception. I thought Picket Fences, the first three seasons of that, was some of the most exquisite writing. And it's not on there at all, nor do I think is any of the stuff by David Kelly, who wrote most of the episodes. Ally McBeal's not on there, Boston Legal and The Practice.
Oh, yes.
So, I think David Kelly is in the top four or five people who have ever written for television, and I don't think any of his shows are on there.
They're not. That's a very, very good point. I'm surprised by that.
Are people, you know, I know this is the Writers Guild that made this decision, Bob, but are people able to separate, even people in the Writers Guild, their favorite show from the best written show? You know, when I first saw this list, Marjorie and I were both thrilled because my favorite show of all time happens to be number one, and I think it is well written, but it's really hard distinction to make for real people, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think that's what's interesting about this list is these weren't just real people. They were people in the Writers Guild,
right.
So they know the difference between, for example, this is certainly on a list of the most influential shows. That would have to include Milton Berle, Texaco Star Theater, but I don't think anybody would put that on any list of the best written shows.
Right.
Very influential. So I think this distinction was made pretty well. As I go down this list, every one of them had some extraordinary writing, and the number one, of course, had extraordinary directing and writing and acting and all the rest of it. But the big argument is, in what order should these 100 be? I don't think anybody could argue that any on this list doesn't belong there.
Mm. You know, let's take a contemporary show as number 7 before we get to the calls. I am obsessed with the show, so we will play it. This is the showcase for Don Draper. Let's listen to a little bit piece of this.
I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product, nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent.
You know, Bob, I don't know writing from a cheeseburger, but it seems to me little piece by John Hamm, it's brilliant. Isn't it? Isn't the writing incredible?
Oh, it is. And the pilot episode of that, I've probably seen 24 times. And every single time I watch it, there is a nuance, a subtlety that I will notice that I hadn't noticed before. I think the writing in that show is amazing. However, the greatest monologue on television about advertising was not on Mad Men. It was on 30-something, which also makes this list but considerably further down.
Hey, one last question about 30-something before we go to the calls. Marjorie and I were discussing today. Did any of the ensemble cast, it's number 43.
44.
44, sorry. Did any of the ensemble cast from 30-something ever go on to do anything else?
Timothy Busfield did a lot of stuff. As a matter of fact, I think he's currently, he did other things with Aaron Sorkin, and he went on to another network program called Birds of Paradise, which mm-hmm. included Seth Green and Jennifer Love Hewitt. Ken Olin did a number of things. So, yeah, they did.
Okay, fair enough. Let's take a few calls. We're talking to Bob Thompson from the he's the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University.
I should have to correct myself.
What's up?
30-something was tied with Law and Order and Downton Abbey at number 43.
I think people could have lived with
the mistake. Accurate.
Mike, you're in the car. You're on with Bob, Jim, and Marjorie. Hey there. What's your number one?
Hey, guys. For me, you know, and I haven't seen the list, but for me, it's got to be West Wing. You mentioned Aaron Sorkin earlier.
Yep.
That show is absolutely phenomenal. It was great to see him get the recognition he deserves with The Social Network.
Well, by the way, he is number 10. Let's play a little piece of West Wing if we can. It made the top 10.
I am tired of working for candidates who make me think I should be embarrassed to believe what I believe. Because somebody came along and said liberal means soft on crime, soft on drugs, soft on communism, soft on defense, and we're going to tax you back to the Stone Age because people shouldn't have to go to work if they don't want to. And instead of saying, well, excuse me, you right-wing, reactionary, xenophobic, homophobic, anti-education, anti-choice, pro-gun, leave it to Beaver trip back to the 50s, we cowered in the corner.
Boy, that's
that
pretty good
great.
Stuff, too, huh, Bob?
That was great. You disappointed us, number 10, or is that okay with you?
Well, number 10's not too bad,
it's
considering
not too bad.
Above it is The Wire and Mary Tyler Moore and all the rest of it. But and the amazing thing about The West Wing and Aaron Sorkin in general is that he can do that kind of complete, preachy, self-righteous kind of stuff and make it sound so good. And that is a lot harder to do than it sounds.
That's exactly what it was. That is beautifully put. Let's go to Walter in the car. You're on with the three of us right here on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the Writers Guild's 101 Best Written Shows Ever. Hey, Walter.
Hi, Walter.
You and I will probably remember this show, but I know Marjorie never will. But
of course not.
I kind of like The Honeymooners.
Oh, yeah.
One of the greatest comedies. Jackie Gleason and Art Carney, one of the most brilliant shows
number
ever.
Number 31.
I only saw the top 10. Now, one other point of interest, Jim.
Yeah.
Broadside should be broadcast twice, not at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, fine.
I can't make it at 6.
Thank you, Walter. I appreciate it. Bob, that's the show I do at
Broadside.
Nights, which didn't quite make the list.
Actually, it is at 102, though. I've got the next 100.
Hey, Bob Thompson, I was upset. Honeymooners is one of my two or three favorite shows ever. And Marjorie and I were talking this morning about why it only made 31. And my analysis was, as great as the show was, it was more about the four lead actors than it was about the script. Am I right?
Well, yeah, I think probably if you would have taken those exact scripts and put four other actors in them, as a matter of fact, there were other actors in early Honeymooners iterations, I don't think it would have been the show that it
was. Well, wait a second.
Who was Jackie
Who were
Gleason?
They?
Oh, before Honeymooners as a series, oh, believe it or not, only played one season, 39 episodes.
I knew that.
Classic
yep.
39, they're called. And but they used to do sketches on the old Jackie Gleason variety show, and somebody else I can't remember off the top of my head played his wife. It wasn't Joyce Randolph in the beginning. Jackie, of course, always played Ralph, but they had some cast adjustments before that single season and 39 episodes, and it was off.
Why?
Its ratings weren't all that high,
wow.
And they then ultimately replowed them into Jackie'd been doing Honeymooner sketches on shows before, and he would do them later, including a couple of color ones. And that's whenever you go on a DVD and get these The Lost Episodes, they're the ones that have been lifted from his variety show.
Were they modeled on Laurel and Hardy? I assume they were. Were they?
Many people say they were, that the Flintstones was modeled on the Honeymooners. Honeymooners, I mean, it was essentially about two married couples, so Laurel and Hardy weren't that, but they certainly borrowed from an awful lot of the classic comedy, even of the silent era. You occasionally found little bits of Buster Keaton in there, and Laurel and Hardy, and Hal Roach and Max Sennett stuff. But by far the best work I think Jackie Gleason ever did on television.
Now, I'm going to embarrass myself and tell you, and be kind, Bob Thompson, my favorite one-liner from Stephen Wright. Are you ready for this?
All right.
The Stones, they just keep doing it. Fred and Barney. What is that, do anything for you or no?
Yeah, that's
okay.
That,
fine.
That should be on a list of some kind.
Of some kind.
Let's go to Eileen in Plaistow, New Hampshire. What do you think, Eileen?
I have two. I have Boston Legal and Northern Exposure. Both excellent, smart written shows.
And what's Northern Exposure? What's your verdict on that, Bob?
53.
Northern Exposure is on this list somewhere. 53.
53. Yeah. Yep.
And I think was a very fanciful, interesting. Fun show. Twin Peaks kind of got all of the attention for being so experimental, and Northern Exposure slips in right after that, but it was a really great show. I also agree with Boston Legal, which was one of those David Kelly shows I mentioned that I don't think is on
there. I don't think it's on there either, unless I've missed it. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Hey, Eileen, thank you so much for the call. You know what we should do? Because
what should we do?
We should at least start moving towards the top here with
yes,
Bob.
Should.
Number two on the list is, I think most people think, one of the three or four greatest comedies. Are you okay with Seinfeld being number two, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, Seinfeld was what it was because of so many different things, namely performance and writing. I don't think I would have put it number two, but I'd have put it near the top.
Let's listen. This is Jerry. He's irate when a rental car company won't honor his reservation. Here it is.
I don't understand. I made a reservation. Do you have my reservation?
Yes, we do. Unfortunately, we ran out of cars.
But the reservation keeps the car here. That's why you have the reservations.
I know why we have reservations.
I don't think you do. If you did, I'd have a car. See, you know how to take the reservation. You just don't know how to hold the reservation.
That is unbelievable.
Now, you know what proves that that's great writing? The fact that you can listen to that on radio.
Yeah.
You don't even need the picture, and that is still hysterically funny.
Yeah, it is wildly funny. Our number is 877-301-8970. Marjorie and I just know what we like. Bob Thompson actually knows what he's talking about. He's the director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at Syracuse University.
You know, one quick thing, Bob. I Love Lucy came in 12th, and that was a great comedy. And I guess 12th is pretty good. But I thought, every time I looked at Lucille Ball when I was a kid, I used to start laughing. Shouldn't it have done a little bit better, or am I crazy?
Well, again, I suppose we're talking about are you giving this to a great performer or you're giving it to great writing?
Yeah.
Now, I think it deserves to be as high as it is, number 12, because it was so meticulously put together. I play the episode where she has her baby in class every year, and that thing is just so perfectly structured, as are 20 or so other of their classic episodes. But I think 12 is probably about
okay.
right.
That's all right. Right. Let's go to Anderson in the car. What do you think, Anderson?
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for the call.
Pleasure.
I for my money, it's Arrested Development all the way.
Number 16. Did quite well. Why would you put it up there, Anderson?
Well, I'll tell you, the density of the jokes, there's a lot to enjoy because all the jokes work kind of on a surface level, but then when you think about it, and then when you think about them in the context of other episodes or other seasons, the jokes get funnier and funnier because they've got three or four punchlines that you just maybe don't realize yet.
You and, also mentioned to one of our producers with whom you spoke before you spoke to us, you saw it all in one sitting or at least one season in one sitting?
Well, I had a fortunately timed hangover from my brother's bachelor party, so I was in no shape to do anything but watch television. So I did make it through the new season in one shot, and I thought it was very good. The thing that I love about the show is stuff like this. Joe Bluth, one of the brothers who rides a Segway, you know, in the first three seasons, that dumb scooter. He rides up to people and changes the topic of conversation whenever he shows up on this thing. So his Segway is a literal segue.
That's pretty good. Hey, Anderson, thank you, Fudge, for the call. Hey, Bob Thompson is an expert in this field. How do you feel about what's being called binge viewing? That's the way I see almost every series. Someone says, have you seen, I don't know what I can think. Oh, Lost is something I saw virtually all of
not
the 100
the
episodes
list.
Over. Yes, it is on the list.
It is?
Over
it.
A week. Are you a binge viewing aficionado or do you oppose it?
Well, I think there are some wonderful shows like the Beverly Hillbillies that I don't want to watch 8 hours in a row of. And I think that's a perfectly fine show and did some brilliant stuff. However, there are certain kinds of shows where the best way to watch it is 6-7 hours at a time. Lost is a good example of that, especially if you've never seen it before.
Yep.
Homeland, Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad,
if,
yeah.
If you can manage the time to lock the doors and turn off the lights and do it, you get an appreciation that you don't have if you're waiting not only a week between episodes, but sometimes a year between seasons.
Breaking Bad, by the way, is number 13, and Homeland came in number 48. Where was Lost? I couldn't find Lost.
No, Lost is somewhere.
Way down there.
Way down, okay.
Let's take another one. Let's go to Mary in the Car. You're on Boston Public Radio with Bob Thompson, Jim, and Marjorie. Hey there, Mary.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I've got a tie.
Okay.
The Wire?
Number nine.
And Friday Night Lights is number 22. Yeah, make the case, Mary. Why do you love them?
Both of those shows draw you in, and you don't feel like you're watching actors or performances.
Yeah.
You feel like you're watching
Great point.
A story. And you are so in that story. And after it's over, it sits with you, and you think about the characters, and you think about what happened to them. I just think those two are exceptionally well-written shows.
Yeah, that's a great description. Thanks, Mary, Bob, of good writing, is it not? When you feel
yeah,
you're in
so
the story.
Glad. To see Friday Night Lights on that list and as high as it was, because that's one of those shows that doesn't get the attention of the Breaking Bads and the Homelands and stuff. And I was glad to see that on there. And, of course, The Wire, there are many people who think that The Wire is the greatest show ever made in the history of the medium, and it, I think, deserves to be maybe a little higher than it was. By the way, Lost is 27.
27, thank you.
And, by the way, all of those people who think it's the best show in the history of the medium, Bob, would be wrong. Because the best show in the history of the medium is number one on this list. Let's listen to it. Here it comes.
This is WGBH 89.7, your source for local news and talk. We're Boston's NPR news and culture station.
I'm not a kid.
Relax, it's an expression.
Well, here's another expression. You got 5 days to give me my money. Come on. That was out of line.
Billy, he's a boss.
If we didn't catch that, our sincere apologies, by the way. But putting that aside for a second, I think Sopranos is the best thing I've ever seen and the best written thing I've ever seen. You want to disabuse me of that notion,
well,
Bob?
Well, it's certainly up close to the top. I mean, I suppose if you were to ask me what would I put on number one, Sopranos would be one of the candidates. St. Elsewhere would be one of the candidates, which makes it pretty high on this list.
Mm-hmm.
The Wire would certainly be... another one, but for the total package, there's The Sopranos is really up there, and it's interesting. Many people considered the Godfather movies the greatest movies ever made. So, what does that tell us about American culture?
We
when
love
all
the
our
mob.
Masterpieces are about mob.
Well, what does it tell us about? That's a good point. What does it tell us about American culture? Because
well,
I feel the way about the movies too.
I think organized crime took the settling the frontier, the urban frontier, took the place of our old mythology of the actual geographical frontier, and the great crime epics took the place of the westerns, which used to be our great story.
Is any, by the way, speaking of that, we're very short on time, only have a minute. Did any western make the list of the top 101, Bob?
I think Gunsmoke is on there somewhere, but... I can't be certain of that. Oh, Deadwood, of course.
Oh, Deadwood, okay.
Yeah, that's way up there. And deserves to be, although don't watch that with your kids in the house.
No, it's very violent.
You're going to miss words playing clips of that. There's probably not a single clip you
that you can actually play. Hey, we want to thank you. Bob Thompson, the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. You were a great addition to this discussion. Thanks
that
so much.
That was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much
thank
for joining
you very
us. We appreciate
much.
It.
Do we have time for the top 10?
Well, we don't have time for the sound, but read the top 10 in reverse order, if you would.
10 is, what is
West
10?
Wing.
West Wing. 9 is The Wire. 8 is Cheers. 7, Mad Men. 6, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Number 5, MASH. Number 4, All in the Family. Number 3, The Twilight Zone. Number 2, Seinfeld. And number 1, The Sopranos.
Show made me very happy. Two of my favorite things. Great television shows and coffee. Oh, plus Brian McGrory. And plus, I mean, all these other things. And in any case, that is it for today. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Hope you'll tune in tomorrow. Beverly Scott, who is great, is the general manager, the brand new general manager of The Tea. She joins us. She'll take your calls and questions, that sort of thing. In the interim, you can follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio. That's Boston Public Radio. Follow me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. As I've said before, we have reporters every single day in the courtroom for the Whitey Bulger trial. Anything that happens that matters, we will share with you. I think that's it.
I think that's it, Jim.
You know, we almost never write about anything. Number one.
I know, you almost got weepy.
I did get a little weepy. Bruce Springsteen had been on The Sopranos, it would have been even better. But it's, okay. His side man is in it. In any case, I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you tomorrow at noon.